I'm Frank McGee with a question. Who killed Robert Kennedy? Who killed Martin Luther King? Were the killers individuals shaped of their own making, isolated, erratic, outside the norm? Or were they shaped of our making, the natural products of an unnatural society? And if this be true, as indeed some argue, then are all of us guilty? Do we live in a violent nation? Is our society sick?
America, the vision and the violence. Here again, Frank McGee.
There is a kind of melancholy, a depressing symbolism, if you will, in the fact that any human being's first contact with another human being is a blow on the back, the blow he or she receives when, eased or coaxed or torn from the womb, he or she is literally battered into the act of breathing. And there may be also a kind of melancholy in the fact that the first sound the human being utters is not a cry of joy or a shout of triumph, but a scream to pull into the lungs the first vital breath of alien air. Well, is there an omen in this? Is there a parallel here, however depressing, of the way in which a society is born, in the way in which breath and function are created in a nation? Certainly, with colonial activist performing as midwife or obstetrician, the United States was born in violence, torn from its mother nation, Britain, and pummeled into being by an urge and a need to exist. Few nations, I think we can say no nation, has embraced in less than 200 years of life such an incredible experience of movement and growth and change, such a non-stop infusion of new peoples and new thoughts, new frontiers, such a headlong and often chaotic rush to grow, to accomplish, to achieve, to win. Our question tonight is whether, in the process of all this, whether in the pursuit of plenty and nationhood, we have abandoned or grown to ignore or never really learned that morality which envisioned America as the last great hope. Have we had time to become, or do we care to become, something other than a collection of irresponsible individuals having in common little more than a toleration, if not an endorsement, of violence? Just after the shooting of Senator Robert Kennedy, these words, uttered by writer-historian Professor Arthur Schlesinger, Jr.
What sort of people are we Americans? And the answer which much of the world is bound to return is that we are today the most frightening people on this planet. The ghastly things we do to our own people, the ghastly things we do to other people, these must at last compel us to look searchingly at ourselves and our society before hatred and violence rushes on to more evil and finally tear our nation apart.
And again,
we cannot blame the epidemic of murder at home on deranged and solitary individuals separate from the rest of us. For these individuals are plainly weak and suggestible men stamped by our society with a birthright of hatred and a compulsion toward violence. We must recognize, I believe, that the evil is in us, that it springs from some dark, intolerable tension in our history and our institutions. It is almost as if some primal curse had been fixed on our nation. We are a violent people with a violent history, and the instinct for violence has seeped into the bloodstream of our national life.
This, then, is our question for tonight. Is there some virus in the national bloodstream? Are we trapped in our own history and snared by our own myths? What are the pressures on the American individual? What are the pressures on the American society? Have we, in fact, had too much too soon? This is Wall Street, the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Each morning, 5 days a week, the opening bell strikes at 10 o'clock, and there is set into motion the whole process of buying and selling in the economy of America. From the floor, there issues a sound one can liken only to the swarming of some giant and slightly crazy hive. And indeed, there is a touch of mania in all this, because here, if a fortune can be made, it can also be lost. So if there is a rags-to-riches philosophy in this country, there is also what you might call the counter-philosophy of riches to rags. Surely the American can become rich, or at least comfortable. But is this enough? Does it bring a sense of security? In the opinion of one observer of the American, the answer is no. Indeed, says Dr. David Abrahamson, wealth has brought wariness.
This is the mightiest country in the world. What are we afraid of? Yes, we are afraid of our wealth, that it might be taken away from us. And each one feels the same. And so therefore we are insecure. For instance, and this is another little thing here, every morning the children have to pledge their allegiance to the flag. Why? I cannot forget the first time when I was in school and heard it. I was surprised. Why? If we are sure about our own flag, if we are sure about our own country, about our own identity, we don't need to go and proclaim every day allegiance to the flag. We know what we are, and we are what we are. And this, you see, reflects an insecurity on our part.
In fact, our wealth, again in the opinion of Dr. Abrahamson, becomes a problem of the national personality.
There is no country, really, which has so much affluence as we have, so much wealth. For which reason, your ambitions gets more intensified and stronger. And with ambitions, of course, comes competition and wanting really to go ahead and wanting to take part of this large wealth we have here in the United States. So the image throughout America is the same. Money, success, and power. And on that background, there must be a great deal of outpouring of aggression.
Can it be said, then, that on the basis of this, that we're a sick society?
To say that we are a sick society is really possibly to go a little too far, although I have certainly my suspicions about it. It is, of course, a very hard thing to prove whether we are more violent than other people. But thinking in terms of individual violence, I think we are. Now, we do have, for instance, our own morality, our own guidelines for living and so on. And the thing we really like to have here in this country, as you know, is success and money and power. And these three factors must mobilize or intensify hostile aggression in everyone. There is no doubt about that we have the highest degree of violence of all civilized nations.
Well, that I think is a bit of nonsense that is very generally perpetrated all over. I don't see any particular reason for that.
This is Dr. Ernest Vandenhaag, author, sociologist, psychologist. He holds views on whether America is a violent society. Even the experts disagree. Dr. Vandenhaag on whether the murders of Senator Kennedy and Dr. King could have occurred in other foreign countries, on whether the United States is more violent than other nations.
Oh, not only could they did. Political assassination, in fact, is far more frequent, I would say, in Europe and South America than it is here. And in this country, it is usually the work of a madman.
So are Americans that different?
I do not really think that our temper is particularly violent, that there are any particular social reasons leading to violence. I do not think that our share of madmen is greater than the proportion of madmen, say, in France or England. There is no evidence one way or the other, but I have no reason to believe that we have more madmen. I do not think that our tendency to violence is greater.
Yet there is assuredly violence in our history, and one troublesome question is whether the experience of this history has tended to become a way of life, a manner of thinking. Dr. Sherbert Fraser, professor of psychiatry at Columbia University.
I agree that in our culture there is more permissiveness to the expression of strong and violent and aggressive feelings than in most other cultures I know about. This is to say that we have a pioneer spirit, a frontier psychology among nations, and therefore we have gained our prowess and our reputation for being out in front and pretty powerful and pretty much beating down the wilderness and the forest and making our homes here. It's a relatively young country, so that perhaps we are among the most violent of peoples. I don't think this makes us different from other peoples. I think it makes us, some people might say, perhaps less civilized, but at any rate, aggressive. There is the evidence of frontier attitudes and the evidence of lack of control, the evidence of impulsive behavior and the expression of hostility and anger and resentment and violence. Pretty evident in the culture.
Well, are you saying then, to use the phrase, that our own history is permissive?
It is permissive, yes. If you look at the history of colonial times and the Revolutionary War, there was a great deal of family violence and people telling their neighbors, you come with us or leave the country. And the historical perspective demonstrates that a man stood up, protected his family, and defended his rights and fought it out. So that I think it is, it's in the history.
So there is a dilemma now as to how an individual can assert himself. In other words, the problem of how a man is to prove he is a man, Dr. Frazier?
I guess in earlier times, men fought with their muscles and demonstrated their prowess. And they didn't have to put it in tangible assets. But as we have gone from a rural economy, an agrarian economy, where you grow your own food and raise your own meat and take care of your family by protecting the family primarily from the enemy, there's an increasing use of items for barter or money or some symbol to buy these commodities. And as a result, the accumulation of commodities is a way of the man saying to himself, I am providing for my family, I am protecting my family, I am demonstrating that I am the masculine protector, provider, head of my house kind of thing. Many of the stories on TV have to do with a settler protecting his family from the enemy so that he's demonstrating his ability. And part of the gratification that we get by watching such things is a recall of the role of primary protector or primary provender for the family. We don't have many ways to demonstrate that I'm the head of this family in this culture now.
Which very well could be part of the problem. Certainly the gun, the rifle, the pistol suggests those less crowded, less supervised days when a decent man with a trusty weapon could step into the forest or into the dusty street of a cattle town and negotiate his own destiny. This is a rifle range on Long Island in New York, one of thousands in the United States. There are shotguns, rifles, pistols, tattered targets waving in the air, dust exploding into sudden life behind the pits, and nearly everywhere, guns. Even a sidearm on the belt of the man selling hot dogs outside the firing lines. And only a few miles away at an amusement park, even more guns, radio or electric guns for the children. There is, of course, the merry-go-round and the little train and the ponies, but in the arcade, the emphasis is on the gun. The gun that shoots down the flying saucer. The monster gun. The space gun. The gun that fires at Indians. The gun that fires at white renegades. And there is very often the father there, praising some Moppet for a good score, or chiding him as a bad shot. So in this case, manliness has to do with guns, and guns have to do with the frontier. Now what about the psychology of the man and the gun? A law professor at the University of Chicago, Franklin Zimring.
There's certainly a tremendous amount of symbolism which can be tied into the possession of either a handgun or a rifle. as the frontier tradition of self-sufficiency, I suppose, although I haven't met many hunters, even good ones, who live off what they bag these days. I don't know anybody who fought the Indians personally, who's a part of the problem of violence that we're talking about in this country. The few that are left are too old to be serious problems. There's feelings of power that come to a man who owns a gun, and he can't get those feelings of power very often. He's hemmed in at the job. He's economically limited in the society. He can't strike back at the forces that he feels are depriving him of his manhood, and I think that there's a powerful symbolism in the holding of a gun.
But not everyone needs a gun, so why do some need them and not others?
There is, I would suspect, among many groups in the United States who you would classify as lower income, a tradition of manliness or manhood tied into violence, which is largely absent from upper income groups. And let me add one thing. It is true, no matter how powerless the man in the gray flannel suit feels when he rides downtown, he has certain outlets for his power. He can bark at his secretary. He has certain things that he can feel proud of, positions of authority in society, and the economic capacity to compel goods and services. If he feels miserable, he can go out and buy a boat. And those channels, which may not be adequate and may leave him feeling inadequate.
And there is the matter of the gun as a symbol and as a means of personality expression. There is also, Professor Zimring tells us, the matter of the gunslinger as guide and mentor.
In this country, in this day and age, we get an awful lot of our values from television, from radio, and from the movies. And what do we see? We see a character, he may be a nice, peaceful type in the Western, and Shane or High Noon. He can't solve his problems nonviolently, and he keeps having the problems, and he makes us real mad, and finally he whips the gun out and solves his problems and achieves his goal. And what are the lessons we learn from that? Well, one of them is that we achieve our goals through violent means. We take a look at Lee Marvin or Kirk Douglas or Burt Lancaster, people who we associate with manliness, with power, and they're up there using guns. And our values, our positive view of what goes on there, may influence our values and our behavior at home, I'm guessing. But they're questions where we have to find the answers, and we have to find them pretty soon. We can't just sit around and guess, and we can't be comforted with what may be plausible insights. We've got to find out, to the limits of our ability, what processes are at work, and we've got to find out pretty fast.
The processes at work here, that is, as they affect the young, certainly include horror comics, tawdry movies, and violence on television. Saturday morning, the children's hour on television. There have been studies, surveys, inquiries, but the experts are not agreed. There is a connection between television and violence, says one. There is not a connection, says another. And certainly statistics are of little help here. Some eminent psychologists say a child will watch a violent show, then become violent. Other eminent psychologists say a child will watch a violent show, and that way get the violence out of his system. So on this, there is disagreement. But there is agreement on one point. Television has not paid enough attention to children, to programming for children. A former executive producer now looking into this, Joan Cooney.
Of all the Western democracies, I don't know, and certainly non-democracies, I don't know any who sentimentalize children more than we do verbally, but are in fact less sentimental about them when it comes to dollars and cents or whatever. And by that I mean the parents stand by while the networks program what makes money. The society refuses to put up the kind of money that's really needed to educate the children, etc. Yet we talk a very good game and a very sentimental game about children, but we're not very sentimental when the chips are down. And it just seems to me that the society ought to say to itself, is this, in fact, what we want children to grow up with?
To Mrs. Cooney, now doing foundation research in this area, the problem is one of cooperation. Cooperation among parents, advertising agencies, all the networks, and all television producers.
All these people are parents. And you would think that there would have been, that we could be mature enough in this society to sit down all together and say, well, you may not make quite as much money if you go this route, though I think you would. If less violence was available, then that would not be the competition. There is no question that children are bloodthirsty and that they will unerringly go to the bloodiest, most violent thing on the dial. There's just no, that's absolutely true. But if that was not available, if all of the networks and other people interested, advertisers and so forth, said, let's put on a good block of shows between noon and six for kids every day. Some for the mother, meaning soap opera or whatever, for the mother's interest. But let's make sure it's dotted with some high-quality shows, and we'll all do the same thing. I mean, none of us will put on, something extremely violent or so forth at that time. Then that would be what all the kids would watch, because they're not going to quit watching television. I think we're just not very thoughtful.
But the problem remains. There is aggression in people, in all people. So how can this be expressed best and least dangerously? For these people in the San Francisco Cow Palace a few weeks ago, it was a heavyweight boxing match. Here, in the galleries, at ringside, the fans can work out some of their aggression. And psychiatrists argue that the boxing match, like the bullfight or the Roman chariot race, is a small price to pay. You ruin the few to save the many. True, baseball is the national sport in America, and there is basketball, but there is also wrestling, ice hockey, lacrosse, judo, and, of course, football. All violent contact sports. And in these, the American, again, is pressured to play hard, to win. We are, of course, gratified by a Van Cliburn. We honor the brilliant student. But somehow this does not appeal to the glands. Nothing quite matches the knockout. Nothing hits us like the 90-yard run. Dr. Jerome Greenholz of Farmingdale, Long Island, says he has developed into something of a damned pest. He is an osteopathic surgeon, and in an area where there is heavy stress on Little League football, he will only rarely clear for playing any boy under 14. Dr. Greenholz suspects not the boys' motives, but the parents'.
In some cases, there's no question about it. We've had boys, and it becomes apparent that where the boy is really not very much interested in football or baseball, where it's strictly the father who has initiated the whole business, who has pressed him to become interested in joining a team, and who was continually after the boy to practice and to be a star. In some cases, it's clearly the father who's achieving some sort of ambition in the person of the son.
The question then, at least in some cases, is who is getting what out of the game?
Games and scrimmages are usually played, or almost always played, in the evening. After a boy has had a full day of school, a full day of running around, he's really not in the best physical shape at that time. He's a little tired. If he's not feeling at his best, and it were an unorganized pickup game, he wouldn't play that day. But with parents, coaches, teammates depending on him to play, to scrimmage, there's an awful amount of pressure on him. And so he doesn't dare not show up unless he has a very good reason for it. He plays, although he may not feel at his best, and he may feel a little tired, and that's when injuries occur.
Injuries in what form, doctor?
The long bones of the body, the bones of the arms and legs, thighs and upper arms, grow from their ends. There is a growing area of bone located at each end of all the long bones of the body. These are particularly active during the years of the greatest growth, the growth spurts, which in boys is generally from 12 to 16. But most important of all, the growing end of the long bone, when it's broken, sometimes, despite the best medical care, doesn't heal right. And as a result, there is disturbance in the growth of the particular bone involved, resulting in permanent shortening of an arm, a forearm, thigh, or leg, which is something that the boy may have for the rest of his life.
But often the boy or the father will find another doctor, get clearance, and the boy winds up on the football field.
It's sometimes very apparent if you talk to the father for any length of time that that his reasons for being so vehemently opposed to restricting his son is that he sees his son's participation as sort of a vicarious achievement on his own part of glory, of a means of getting rid of some aggression in an acceptable way, in a socially approved way, and to stop such a thing is meets with just violent objection on the father's part. So if you've attended a Little League game and seen how the mothers react to a bad call, you know that they're out for blood. And it's hard for boys who participate under these circumstances not to develop some of the same attitudes.
These, then, are some of the pressures we face. The pressure to compete, the pressure to win, the pressure to survive. We face them. Can we live through them? You hear a waterfall in a little park. There are many waterfalls in many little parks, but this one is in the middle of America's largest city, New York. In midtown Manhattan, the mass of steel and chrome and concrete pushed back, rests Samuel Paley Park. And perhaps rests is the word here. Because with its man-made waterfall, its geraniums, ivy, cobblestones, and occasional bird, it is in all respects a retreat from the city. Sit here and study the faces of the people who step in from the sidewalks. They are the faces of people who appear to have closed the cabin door on a blizzard behind. They're the faces of people for whom a bad round has just ended. Now, we're concerned tonight with violence in America. And it's easy and fashionable to say that if indeed there is violence in America, the big city is one of the villains, that we must somehow decentralize, that we must somehow lessen the crowding. So let's look at this. Is a big city necessarily an evil? Is crowding inherently dangerous?
Most people believe that crowding is bad. I used to believe it also, but I now have changed my views.
This is Dr. Rene DuBose of Rockefeller University. Dr. DuBose believes the problem is not one of crowds, but one of cultural assimilation. In other words, of learning to get along together. And he speaks here of experiments in the laboratory.
Suppose that you go and collect rats or mice from different places and put them in one given area. The result is simple. There is an immense agitation. The animals begin to fight. They often kill each other. In any case, a large percentage of them become sick and die. But suppose you start from a small number of animals. Those animals will start to multiply to such an extent that within a short time they will reach very large population density. And yet, such animal populations do not fight. They establish some kind of social order which makes it possible for them to survive, to remain healthy, and to remain peaceful. I realized that rats are not human beings, but nevertheless, I have a very strong suspicion that whenever a population becomes crowded through the introduction of people from the outside, there is a period of social conflicts which is almost inevitable.
It's not a question of mere population density, then.
Human beings have always wished to live under crowded conditions, contrary to what one says. anyone who has visited any one of the famous medieval or Renaissance cities of Italy realizes how densely populated they were then, and of course how densely populated they are today. I believe that Hong Kong is the most crowded city in the world, and I believe that Holland is the most crowded country in the world. And the fact of importance here is that even though Holland and Hong Kong have been very crowded areas for long periods of time, they are also among the healthiest, both from the physical and from the mental point of view.
But the accommodation reached by Hong Kong, by Holland, by many of our own cities, was not guaranteed. And perhaps such an accommodation could have been reached earlier, or perhaps Americans can reach one earlier. At least this is the hope of a group of scientists in Massachusetts. They are theorizing that the violence involved in learning to live together need not be merely accepted. They believe that at least in some cases the violence can be predicted. Here's a spokesman for these scientists, Dr. Frank Irvin.
This issue of individual violence is one that we have left in limbo so long. We have taken a moralistic position about it, or just a punitive position about it. That is, the society of violence that you're talking about responds to the violent individual by wiping him out, essentially, and has not asked the serious question of what's going on, what can be done about it, can it be predicted, can it be prevented.
Dr. Irvin is director of the Stanley Cobb Laboratories, head of psychiatric research at Massachusetts General Hospital, and an associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard. His team is looking into brain damage as a source of violence, but also into the whole question of violence, the brain, the emotions, the cellular makeup of a patient, his family background, his environment. It's the new science of psychobiology. Dr. Irvin on violence and the patient.
We have for the past 9 months now tried to look carefully at a series of people who seek out medical help for their subjective concern about episodes of violence. These are people who know that they're out of control and who are concerned about it and who seek help. Now, what's striking is their history as one goes through it is they have frequently sought help over and over again, and nobody has been willing to accept this as a medical problem. It has been thought of as a legal problem or a moral problem or an ethical problem. And the guy has been bounced back to his minister, his lawyer, his friendly neighborhood cop, or what have you. Now, as we've tried to work with these patients, well, a number of things emerge. In the first place, it is not so simple, as indeed they all have strong evidence of focal brain disease. Many of them do. More, we think, than a normal, quote, normal population or a random population. Many of them don't. Many of them have histories of coming from violent families. And indeed, one of the studies that has been done on parents who beat children, the so-called battered child syndrome. There's been a very careful review of what these parents are like, where they come from. These parents frequently were battered children when they were children. And indeed, their parents were frequently battered children. This is frequently a third or fourth generation epidemic disease, if you will.
All animals fight, but there is something unique, apparently, about the human animal. Again, Dr. Irvin.
There is almost no animal in the wild, under normal circumstances, which will kill another member of its own species, except for man. Now, there are other animals who fight with intra-species fighting, and particularly in those that are dangerous animals, in our sense, that is, who are predators. The classic example that's used over and over again is the wolf. Dangerous animal. when two male wolves fight during mating season and one begins to triumph over the other, the loser lies down and extends his neck in position to receive the typical wolf death bite.
The neck bite.
The neck bite. When he makes that gesture, the triumphant wolf is frozen. He is instinctively turned off and never makes that bite. One wolf never kills another if he's a normal wolf in the wild. Now, because of this phenomenon, many of the people who've worked with animals, the ethologists who look at this class of behavior, have suggested that perhaps man's ancestry is not from a predatory line, but from a non-predatory line, so that he has failed to evolve these intra-species control mechanisms which prevent him from killing or injuring another member of the same species.
You have a different view, I take it.
I would be equally willing to argue that the evidence is against that, that man, in fact, engages in very little direct destructive behavior against another human being. That even in wartime, where it's sanctioned, indeed considered a good thing, to wipe out other individuals on the other side of the line, the guys involved find it very difficult, apparently, to kill another human being whom they can see and identify as an individual. It becomes fairly easy to push a button and drop bombs, to load a mortar shell and fire it off. But time after time, the guys say, you know, came around the building and there was Charlie or a German or what have you. And, gee, he was just another guy like me. Even with apparent life in danger, it's difficult to overcome strong constraints in most of us about actually damaging another single individual.
We do kill, though.
One of the things that makes it easier to overcome what I'm suggesting as a real barrier about hurting somebody else is the dehumanization of the other person. Now, indeed, in wartime, we perhaps instinctively or perhaps cleverly indulge in this by working hard to dehumanize the enemy. It's easier to shoot a Hun or a Wop or a Gook than it is to shoot another man. It's easier to shoot a communist or to kill a nigger or to burn a honky than it is to damage another man.
I have a question, or let me say, give me your opinion. Do you think we're a sick society?
Well, you've asked for an opinion. My opinion is yes, but let me back off. Somehow our society has not behaved in a responsible way to itself. If you see an individual who is so little concerned about his appearance, about his nutrition, about his internal health, you figure he's some kind of a nut. And when you see a society which shows so little concern about its integrity, about its health, about its aesthetics, and about its creative potential, you have to assume the same kind of thing. And it's this class of things that lead me to say that, yeah, there's something sick about this. And we've got things all out of proportion.
Dr. Frank Ervin, but if it's a sick society, and that's arguable, is it also a guilty society? Is there, as Professor Schlesinger suggested earlier, some curse upon us? Is it fair to say, as some have, that all of us, played some role in the murders of President Kennedy, Dr. King, and Senator Kennedy? A Washington psychiatrist, Dr. Michael Halberstam.
I think that what we've seen recently has been the kind of escalation of language among college professors and among New York intellectuals and Hollywood part-time politicians, a use of language in describing events which has no relationship to the events themselves. There are elements of violence in this country, and if we're going to deal with them, we can't go around just labeling everybody violent. We have to find out where the violence is, what causes it, and we have to use the same understanding and compassion towards the violent streaks in this country that we do for our other social problems. Violence is not a Western trait, it's a human trait. It's something that we ought to control, but we don't have any patent on it.
But the slayings did bring on a great emotional reaction. Now, was this properly the occasion for a feeling of guilt?
In psychiatric terms, this would be an occasion for shame rather than guilt. We haven't lived up to our promise as individuals or as a nation. And shame is certainly one of the things that if you had to apply any collective label to the country, we should feel. Shame does not imply unworthiness in the person who feels shame. He feels ashamed because he didn't live up to his ideal. He doesn't say, I'm a miserable sinner, that I am worthless, and that everything I will ever do is worthless. He says, I'm really a good person, whereas the guilty person, in the most profound sense, says, I'm guilty, I am worthless, I cannot achieve any good because basically I am no good myself. That's an extreme separation of the two concepts, but I think it is a valid one. And therefore, the person who feels guilty, or the nation which feels profoundly guilty, is not going to be able to effectively deal with the problems that it that it's confronted by. And also, of course, again, although shame is the emotion or the feeling that we should perhaps most appropriately have as a nation, it still is not universal. There's no one who can escape this by thinking of other people as a group. They did this, or we did this. You have to look at yourself.
Looking ahead, Doctor, what would be your prognosis?
Personally, I'm optimistic, and I see reasons to be optimistic. And I think we're going to go through a hell of a couple years, and the things may get worse before they get better. But basically, we are finally facing up to our terrible problems at home, and I think we will be able to solve them. We won't be able to solve them if we despair.
H. Rapp Brown, hurling verbal thunderbolts at a Washington rally a year ago, sought to justify his own violent behavior by declaring, "Violence is as American as cherry pie." In a way, this is symptomatic of what's happening in the United States. The violence begins verbally, and its first victim is reason. Brown is wrong. Violence is not as American as cherry pie. Anyone who thinks for a moment will realize that most people in this country have and will live out their lives, settling problems in their families and with their neighbors without resorting to violence. A little further thought will lead to the realization that hundreds of sharp political, social, and economic disagreements between segments of our society have been resolved without one group using violent means to compel the other to acquiesce. To pursue this into a larger framework, most disagreements between the United States and other countries have been settled without war. Now, no one fails to recognize that parents often fight between themselves and batter their children, and that neighbors turn upon each other, and that violence has marked many disagreements between larger elements within the society, and that the United States has resorted to war. The point is, these are the exceptions and not the rule, and that violence, prevalent as it is abnormal, not normal behavior. If it were not abnormal, it would not cause the concern it's now prompting. The political assassinations that have left this society numb with horror would hardly cause a ripple in many other societies. The violent actions of some groups in the United States are accepted modes of behavior in some countries, not all of them distant and politically primitive. This is not said to excuse violence here, but to emphasize that we know it is not the way this society is intended to function. Violence, after all, is a means of accomplishing change. The question is whether it will become an acceptable means. And much of the answer lies in whether other means will or will be permitted to work. The basic institutions of this society were structured to accommodate change. In the opinion of many Americans, they are not doing so, or are not doing so with sufficient speed. Still, one of the most pertinent questions we should ask ourselves is whether this is an inherent fault of the institution or whether the blame lies with the elected leaders and bureaucrats who man the institutions. The answer would determine whether the leaders and bureaucrats should be banned through means that are available, or whether the institutions should be abolished through means that some are advocating. This country was founded on the belief that people could govern themselves. And that was either impudent nonsense that overlooked the quarreling, greedy nature of man that would lead him inevitably to violence and collapse, or a lofty vision that held there were better elements in the nature of men that would permit them to reconcile their differences and live in peace. The question is still before us and the world. Each of our acts moves us a step, large or small, toward one answer or the other.